Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and this news just in, the Lord is risen. Happy Easter to you. Happy Easter to everyone celebrating the joy of this season for us Catholics and for many, many Christians. It's Easter until next Sunday. And then, because we're really Catholic, then it's still Easter until Pentecost. So I can say Happy Easter for a long, long time. We don't do one-day feasts in the Catholic Church. We do eight-day feasts, and then we extend those out to 50 days when they're Easter. We're going to have a really good show for you today, great conversations. In the second hour, you might kind of wonder, what happened between the resurrection and the ascension of the Lord? Like, what happened in that period? And since we're celebrating the resurrection all this week and all the next 50 days, we'll talk about that with Tim Staples. This hour, we've got Trent Horn with us, the great apologist and debater and author, Trent Horn, and we're going to talk about, did that resurrection of Jesus, and I mean a physical resurrection, that his body is not there in the cave anymore, in the tomb anymore, because he is risen, and he can walk around, and he can eat fish and all of that. So is there evidence for that? Can we really believe that story? Trent Horn, thanks for being with us here on this Easter Monday.
Oh, thank you, Cy. It's a treat to be here. Happy Easter. I think it'd be funny if just like you turn the cameras on for the interview and it's Easter Monday. Like my face is just like covered in chocolate or I'm drinking coffee. Like I'm doing every stereotypical thing I couldn't do during Lent. I'm like, hey, Cy.
Good to see you, Trent. Yes. That's right. All the people are done with their Lenten sacrifices. Everybody's back to.
It's open hunting season on the chocolate bunnies.
Yes, right. Those Catholics back to eating their chocolate, drinking their coffee. I knew some people who gave up coffee. I knew one person who gave up coffee, and it lasted, I think, the first 3 days of Lent, and then he was back to drinking coffee. So now he can just drink his coffee without feeling guilty about it. By the way, I think a lot of people, Trent, they get to Easter, or they get to Holy Week, and they go, I didn't do Lent very well. And they feel they're kind of depressed about it. And they don't feel, now I can't really celebrate in the joy of Easter because I didn't really. You know what? All the apostles failed. They still got to celebrate in the joy of Easter. The joy of Easter is for everybody, whether you did good or bad during Lent, whether you had a blessed and holy struggle or you just blew it. Easter joy is for you.
Amen to that, Cy. I love that the resurrection is for all of us. It gives hope to the darkest depths of our soul that are wounded by sin. Resurrection really gives us hope, and it gives us hope because it really happened. It's the foundation of our Christian faith, and I like telling people about it. I like talking about it. I like debating it. It's a joy to proclaim it and defend it.
I heard a guy say one time, and I don't remember who this guy was. I might have read it in a book, that if he's not raised from the dead, then we're just the most pathetic creatures. I don't remember who that was that said it. I'm paraphrasing, of course. If he's not risen, then there's no point.
Was that something that Harry Carey used to say on his sports broadcast?
I don't think it was Harry Carey. I can't. It's somebody else.
If you were a hot dog, would you eat yourself?
Now that's the...
No.
Go ahead.
That's the impersonation of Harry Carey. Right. No, obviously that is a reference to St. Paul's letter, 1 Corinthians chapter 15, where he talks about how if Christ has not been risen, our faith is in vain.
Yeah.
What's interesting about 1 Corinthians 15, actually, is that it is not an argument for the resurrection of Jesus per se. Rather, what Paul was engaging were people in the church at Corinth who believed that either they had missed the resurrection, like they had missed the train, missed the boat. Like, oh no, the resurrection happened and I wasn't there for it, and there's not going to be any resurrection in the future. Or people who were saying that there wasn't going to be any resurrection of the dead, or there is no resurrection from the dead. And his argument is basically this. It's what we would call, I think it's modus tollens in philosophy. And so he's saying, okay, if there is no resurrection of the dead, modus tollens. So if there is no resurrection of the dead, then Christ has not risen from the dead. Because if nobody rises from the dead, right, then Christ hasn't risen. He says, but wait a minute, Christ has risen from the dead. Therefore, there is a resurrection from the dead, and we have hope in that resurrection, and our hope is in Christ, that we are lowly. Well, this is in 1 Corinthians 15, he talks about the transformation, you know, the change of our bodies happening in the twinkling of an eye. And in his letter to the Philippians, Paul talks about how our lowly bodies will be transformed to be like his glorious body.
So all of that then depends, and it is joyful good news. It is the great good news. It's the unexpected good news that the Lord has come among us, that he's died to save us, and that he has risen in order to prepare a place for us, to prepare a home for us, a final home for us, a home with God our Father. All that depends on that this really happened. So is there historical evidence we can muster to say, yep, indeed it did happen. He is raised from the dead.
Amen to that. He is raised. And there is significant evidence to show that it is reasonable to believe that Christ has risen from the dead.
So I saw you debating a gentleman recently online. You do these really good online debates where... In all of your online debates, you play the unflappable guy, and whoever the opponent is plays the flappable. I don't know if you're supposed to say flappable. Is flappable one of those words where
unflappable? I mean, you could be unflappable, but I don't know if there are flappable people.
That's
there
what
are
I mean.
There are flappers from the 1920s.
Right. Yeah.
They would be somewhat unflappable, I would think.
Right. There's a lot of words that there's a negative form of the word, but there's no positive. Like, I could be disconcerted, but you never hear, I'm totally concerted. Today, completely.
You can be underwhelmed and overwhelmed, but right. Never whelmed.
No one's ever whelmed. So you play the unflappable guy, and in this debate, you played the role of the unflappable guy, giving the historical evidence for Jesus. So would you just give us some of the evidence, and then I'm going to try to poke some holes in it, and we'll see where we get.
Sure. Well, I would say that it's interesting. People have different ways of trying to show that Jesus has risen from the dead. They would say, oh, the evidence isn't good enough to show us a miracle like that. One approach that I like to take is this, that the claim Jesus rose from the dead is really the conjunction of three claims. Jesus was alive, Jesus died, and Jesus was alive again. So he was seen alive, he was seen to be dead, and he was seen to be alive again, right? Those are the three that you need for resurrection. Now, it's funny, some people might say that I don't need point one, because if I have point two, you know, that's, you know, he's obviously alive. The reason I put point one in there is to say, look, Jesus, because one way you could get around the resurrection is to say Jesus was never alive at all. He's a myth, that this is just a myth that was propounded. And the evidence doesn't speak to that, because we have testimony from people who directly saw Jesus, like Paul, or Paul knew people who knew Jesus. So it's not some kind of not a myth. And there's other evidence to show it's not mythic. So seen alive, seen to be dead, seen to be alive again. Well, how do we know, the evidence, if it's good enough for seen alive the first time prior to death, it should be good the second time. That we have evidence Jesus lived, he taught, and then he died by crucifixion. That's universal amongst the Gospels, and even secular scholars will admit Jesus died. So then it really comes down to the third question. Why should we believe Jesus rose? Well, if we're willing to believe the testimony of people who said that yet Jesus was alive and ministered and did these things before he died, we also have evidence from people saying that Jesus was alive after his death in an embodied way. And our primary sources of evidence for that would come from Paul's letter to the Corinthians, 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Paul mentions seeing the risen Jesus and then recites a creed that describes other people who saw Jesus. Peter, the 12, he speaks of groups of people who have seen the risen Jesus. And then you have a dramatic transformation from dejected apostles, disciples, into inspired apostles willing to risk life and limb to proclaim the gospel, which doesn't make sense if there was no real resurrection to motivate them. That's just a little bit of the evidence. We can always go back and forth after the break to dive into it a little deeper.
Okay, I appreciate you pointing that out, because we do need to take our first break of the Easter season. And when we come back, here's the challenge I'm going to make to you. The sources that you cite for this are all Christian sources. If Jesus rose from the dead, why was it not reported in the Jerusalem Gazette? Why don't we have, secular sources affirming this? We'll ask Trent Horn that question right after we come back for more Catholic Answers Live.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Check out EWTN's official YouTube channel.
Just follow the link on our homepage at EWTN.com or go to YouTube.com/EWTN.
Watch EWTN's live shows or today's homily from the Daily Mass.
Click the upload button to see our most recent clips.
You can also find all of EWTN YouTube content by clicking the playlist button.
It's all on the official EWTN YouTube channel at YouTube.com/EWTN.
Visit today.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. So happy to be with you here as Easter week begins and the whole celebration of Easter continues. And wish you and yours a very happy Easter. I hope it is a happy Easter. We're talking with Trent Horn, who's given us the evidence for the resurrection this hour. Next, we'll talk a bit about next hour with Tim Staples. We'll talk a bit about what did the resurrected Jesus do? What happened in those days that he was here before ascending into heaven? And so we'll try to cover the whole resurrection thing in those various ways. But Trent, you're making the argument that the Christian claim that Jesus is raised from the dead is not a spiritual claim or a poetic claim. It's a historical claim about a physical event that, right. that happened. And so it's fair to challenge you, I think, in this way. Well,
sure.
Why was that physical event not more widely reported then? Why don't we have Roman historians or Jewish historians telling us about that?
Well, there would be two different kinds of claims we would expect a source to say. Either that the claim is that Jesus rose from the dead, which would be affirming the resurrection, or the more modest claim, there are people who say Jesus rose from the dead. So just acknowledging that Christians exist. So those would be one of the two claims. And we would ask, would we expect to find these claims in non-Christian sources? And I would just ask you, would you expect a non-Christian source to say Jesus of Nazareth rose from the dead, you know, but and still remain non-Christian?
So
I think it's kind of
I see what you're saying. If you believe he rose from the dead, then what would be your motive for not becoming Christian?
Believing. So it's asking for, you know, an impossible condition, saying I'll only believe Jesus rose from the dead if there is someone who says he rose from the dead but is not Christian, which doesn't really make sense there. So you're disqualifying all of the people who say Jesus rose from the dead because they're Christian. Well, that's a natural consequence of the belief. Of course, you would expect someone who is not Christian or not convinced of that belief,
right,
to not espouse it.
So, can I give an example? Like I'm thinking of an example of this kind of thing. It would be as if I were to say, now I don't believe in UFOs, but let's say there were people who believe in UFOs, and I go, well, the only people who claim to have seen UFOs or people who believe in UFOs. I don't have anyone who doesn't believe
right.
in UFOs
or,
who claims to have seen a UFO.
Show someone who claims that UFOs have an alien origin, but believes that only human beings are the only intelligent life in the universe.
That, if you only accept evidence from the people who deny the evidence, then you're not going to accept any evidence of anything ever.
Right, so we would not expect secular sources to describe. So that'd be number one. But number two would be, we have to also ask, what kind of evidence would we expect given the resurrection account? So what happened here? Now, I agree, this objection would be very powerful if Christians claimed that after Jesus rose from the dead, he appeared to Pontius Pilate. He appeared to the Roman emperor. He appeared to the Roman Senate. You know, if that is what we claimed, and there was no evidence of these appearances in ancient Roman records or documents and things like that, that would be very problematic. But that is not what we claim. What we claim is that the eyewitnesses to Jesus' resurrection, to his ascension, that they are a former persecutor turned convert, Paul, and then Jesus's former, his disciples, and then later, you know, we have Mary and the brothers of the Lord at Pentecost. But we're saying, what kind of evidence would we expect if Jesus only appeared to one Pharisee and then to his disciples? And well, we would expect probably writings from the disciples or people who knew the disciples and writings from this Pharisee. And that's precisely what we do have. We wouldn't expect Josephus or Tacitus or other secular and Jewish historians, Roman and Jewish historians, to note this, you know, because they would, the only thing we would expect from them would be, there are these people who claim Jesus rose from the dead. And in some of these ancient, and there are a lot of ancient Greek writers and ancient Roman writers, you're right, they don't mention Jesus, but they also don't mention Christians at all. And we know, even mythicists have to admit, there were Christians in the first century in Judea and Palestine.
Yes.
So the fact that they don't mention there are people who believe Jesus rose from the dead, or they don't mention the resurrection, well, so what? They don't mention that Christians existed, and even though we know that they did. So it's not that surprising what we would see. We would at most expect these ancient sources to say, here's this splinter sect Jewish group. They follow Jesus, and some of them claim that Jesus rose from the dead. Here's why that's silly. It's not surprising we don't find, you know, we find veiled references to that maybe in Josephus and Tacitus. The first really robust things we get from that might be Celsus, someone that Origen engaged with in the third century, or Lucian of Samosata, who is a he was a Greek satirist in the second century, who talks about fooling Christians and taking advantage of them, and he says they worship a crucified sophist. They still, you know, they still worship him.
Yeah.
So I would say that this is an argument from silence, and we have to just go back to say, okay, arguments from silence only work if we have really good reasons to expect certain kind of evidence, and we do not have good reasons to expect non-Christian sources to talk about the resurrection. We have the evidence we would expect if Jesus appeared to Paul and to his disciples. This is the kind of evidence we would expect. And we also have to remember that in the ancient world, because some people will say, well, why wasn't everybody writing all this stuff down? We have to remember that in the ancient world, studies of literacy, and basically what they would show is maybe about 10% of the Roman population was literate. 10%, 10 to 15%. And that might be people who could only read a few signs or sign their own names. People who are literate enough to write books were probably only like a few percent of the Roman population. In the Jewish population, it would have been even lower, less than 1%. So you have very few people who can write. That's why you hire secretaries. In Greek, it'd be amanuensis, I believe is the Greek term, for these writers that you hired to write this stuff. And then even if you did write the stuff, 99% of ancient literature has not survived to the present day. It's just not, you know, it gets lost. It's written on papyrus, which is just dried leaves essentially that decomposes over time. Later you'd have vellum that would stand up a little bit more, but even then you'd have stuff. It was used. It was transferred between churches. That stuff would the oldest papyrus that we have of the New Testament is a document called P52, also called the Charles Ryland Papyri. It is a section of the Gospel of John, John 18, verses 31 through 33. It is about the size of a credit card. And it's been dated to about the year 125 AD. Which is amazing because actually prior to the Ryland's Papyri, there were liberal scholars who said the Gospel of John was written in the middle of the second century. And then discovering the Rylands papyri, and it's dated to the early second century, which means John's gospel, it had to have been in circulation and copied decades before that. I think one scholar said it sent a century's worth of scholarship into the furnace.
Right. Although a lot of that 19th century scholarship was kind of motivated by, don't you think it just seems like there was a lot of motivated reasoning there? We don't really want to believe in Jesus anymore.
It was higher form criticism that was trying to demythologize scripture. And then a lot of it, especially in the early 20th century, took higher form criticism. And it was part of the school of religions view of the New Testament that tried to make it very connected to paganism. And that's where you get in the early 20th century the rise of the first mythicists, the first people who denied that Jesus even existed. They claimed that he was just a pagan myth. It was not until later in the 20th century that New Testament scholarship reaffirmed or rediscovered the Jewishness of Jesus and the importance of the Jewish backdrop to all of his teachings to show this is not some kind of reformulated or accommodated pagan myth.
We're talking with Trent Horn. Trent Horn, of course, the author of a whole bunch of books, including Persuasive Pro-Life and Answering Atheism and Why We're Catholic. And we're talking about the resurrection, about the historical evidence for the resurrection. One of the things that your interlocutor said in the debate that I watched to kind of prepare for this was, okay, but You might say that all these so you have good reason. He didn't concede this, but let's concede it. Just for the purposes of argument, let's say we conceded. Yeah, okay, that this is the kind of evidence you would expect. It would come from those who were believers. But then the question that he raised is, well, why were they believers? And he says it seems to be some kind of hysterical response where maybe one or two people, maybe the Virgin Mary. He mentioned Saint Peter. These two expected the resurrection, and so they kind of planted the idea in other people's minds, and then it just kind of spread as a grief mechanism, as a hysterical way of dealing with grief. How do you respond to that argument about the resurrection?
Yes. So in my debate with Doug, he did bring that up, and it's something he's brought up before, and other people bring up as a common alternative hypothesis that, well, what the resurrection appearances are, these are just grief-induced hallucinations. So prior to the debate, I did a somewhat extensive study reading different medical journals and other sources on grief-induced hallucinations to say, okay, well, if this is a natural explanation, it must happen with some frequency. What do we see with this phenomena, and does it apply to the New Testament? And the problem is there are a lot of discrepancies where it's not a very good theory. It doesn't explain a lot of things. First, if it's just, you're so grief-stricken that you wish you could see your deceased loved one again, that would not explain the resurrection appearances to James, the relative of the Lord, the brother of the Lord, and Paul. What explains the appearances of them? Number two, I was looking, and this is the reason, by the way, in the debate with Doug, I asked him very particular questions in cross-examination. He had to admit that he had no evidence for. Like, he had no evidence that Paul was grief-stricken over persecuting people, and that's why he saw Jesus. There's no evidence for that. I asked him if there was any peer-reviewed literature where psychologists said that the post-resurrection appearances of Jesus were grief-induced hallucinations. I have not found any peer-reviewed medical literature to diagnose it in this way. Now, you might say, well, psychologists can't diagnose things that happened in the past. No, if you go to PubMed and to other sources that have medical literature, you find psychologists trying to determine things like, what was the cause of dancing hysteria in the Middle Ages? Have you ever heard of this one, Sahi?
Yeah, right, where people just couldn't stop. And then there's also these laughing hysterias that take over groups where they can't stop laughing.
There was actually a slight resurgence of this in the 20th century in a small Midwest town where dancing had been legally prohibited. And one of the town's residents, Kevin Bacon, inspired people to dance, and they simply could not stop. It's been called, their feet were just completely loose and they couldn't do otherwise. I'll stop right there.
Wait a second. I kind of remember this one. And it was a terrible movie. And it involved a game of chicken with tractors. This
oh,
is
yeah,
not
that
history.
Was, I saw that happen in my own eyes. No, but in the Middle Ages, you can read about stories of dancing hysteria of people, you know, entire towns dancing or gyrating and not being able to stop. And psychologists have proposed different explanations for that. Hysteria, mold, hallucinations, things like that. But they haven't done that for the appearances of Jesus. And that was one question. I brought up several others, but I'll discuss when we come back.
Okay, we'll take a quick break and we'll continue our conversation about the historicity. Did it really happen? The resurrection of Jesus. Right after this with Trent Horn.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com. Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
This is Dr. David Anders. Does the problem of evil keep you from believing in God?
Join us for Call to Communion tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live on this Easter Monday. Happy to say, Alleluia, the Lord is risen today, and to say it every day. Well, until Lent starts again, and then we can't say Alleluia for 40 days again. But for now, we can say it, and we can mean it, and we have good evidence for it, and that's what we're here talking with Trent about, is the evidence for the resurrection of the Lord. And Trent, we were just talking before we went to the break about the objection that, well, mass hallucinations are a thing, and perhaps this whole resurrection thing was a mass hallucination, perhaps induced by grief.
Right, and I talked about how, well, when you study grief-induced hallucinations, what you find is not what is recorded in the New Testament about the appearances of Jesus. So one thing that is shown, as I talked earlier before the break, how psychologists have studied this, and none of them, to my knowledge, have attributed this as a hypothesis to study in the peer-reviewed literature for the post-resurrection appearances of Jesus. Even non-Christian scholars, people like Paula Fredrickson, who's, I believe she's Jewish, said the disciples saw something. I don't know what it is, but they did see something. Now you might say, well, it's all in their minds. Here's some other patterns that I noted. Another one was that grief-induced hallucinations in the medical literature appear almost entirely among spouses or family members. You don't find them even among close friends or things like that. This is typically something that occurs among spouses and family members, not among a kind of a teacher-student relationship. I'm not aware of any study that sees that in any detail. Number two would be when people have these experiences, the vast majority of the time when they say, oh, I had a grief-induced hallucination, they only say that I felt a presence of that person. I felt them in the room with me.
Yeah.
Not that they interacted with them in a tactile way. A very, very, only a very small minority of grief-induced hallucinations claim to be tactile in that sort of response. And usually they're very, very unpleasant. The person is unsettled afterwards. They don't consider it a pleasant experience that they've gone through. But the vast majority of them, it's a feeling of a presence that is involved. And I have not been able to find any that show that multiple people share in the grief-induced hallucination at once. So the creed in 1 Corinthians 15 talks about Jesus appearing to the 12, also appearing to 500 people. And some people try to write that off. It's interesting. They say, oh, well, that's just a legend. Paul is making that up, this or that. What's amazing to me, though, is these are the same people who say legends grow over time. And so if it were a legend that grew over time, why don't we have a fantastic legendary appearance to 500 people in the Gospels? The closest we have of what that might be referring to is the mountaintop appearance in Galilee at the end of Matthew's Gospel. That would be a large enough area, and Galilee would have been a large enough village for Jesus to appear to that many people. It would also explain—
I just got to clarify something for people, though. Paul's letters, where the 500 is referred to, were written before the Gospels.
Yes,
so what you're saying is if you would have expected the story to grow then if it was a myth. And
if it was just mythical, why don't we see it? Because that's what people say about the resurrection itself. They'll claim that, well, you know, Mark has a simple account. By the time you get to John, it's more complex. And that's not really the case. They're just focusing on different details. And so they claim that the resurrection appearances are legendary because all these fantastic elements are more so in John and Luke than in Mark. Though with Mark, it's difficult. Mark's ending may have included more resurrection appearances than we have because Mark's gospel may have been published prematurely, that it was a set of notes for other people to make gospels based on. And Jimmy Akin has done work exploring that hypothesis. But my point is that we don't see this kind of legendary development, but we do see that Paul attests very early on, you have things like group appearances. And in the medical literature for grief-induced hallucinations, you don't have more than one person experiencing it at the same time. Also, I was not able to find, and I asked Doug this in the debate, and he didn't provide me an answer, at least that, you know, he couldn't at that time. Maybe he can later. And I asked him, well, are there any cases where one person has a grief-induced hallucination, tells another person, and that person starts hallucinating and seeing the deceased? It's like it's easy for us to imagine that as a hypothesis, but when my studies of grief-induced hallucinations, I have not come across, and maybe there are cases like that, I don't know, but I haven't come across a case where that is what happened to cause that to people. And then there's so much more. You know, we have a whole hour. I can keep going on and on about why I'm not convinced by this. But the other problem is that if you are going to hallucinate, you'd hallucinate in accord with your expectations. So when you look at studies of grief-induced hallucinations, and this does happen, I had I gave a eulogy for... just prior to I gave the eulogy, for a friend of mine who died, she was 19, and I had a dream that I spoke with her. It felt very real. It was before the funeral. And so dreams or a presence of someone, feeling a person's presence, that's not uncommon, these bereavement or grief-induced hallucinations. But when you actually go in and ask people, well, you know, what do you think happened in these situations? Nobody says that they thought that the person is alive now. Like, people have grief-induced hallucinations, and you ask them, okay, is your loved one still alive? They'll say, well, no, obviously they're dead. They're just in a better place. And so we would expect if this is what happened to the disciples, they would think that they saw Jesus, that he is alive in heaven in Abraham's bosom. He has gone to the abode of the righteous where all of the prophets, the righteous prophets who were slain before him, Jesus will go and join them to usher in the kingdom. And, you would expect that, a recognition that he's dead, but he's gone to the abode of the righteous in the land of the dead, not that he is alive. When people have grief-induced hallucinations, they still believe the person is dead, not that they've resurrected to a glorious life. So the proclamation of resurrection, not just survival of death, that is a unique detail that needs to be explained.
So I think we can do away with the hallucination theory. I mean, you can also just do away with it in a kind of common sense way that these people are, they don't come across as people who are like in a cult or something. They just seem like they're so reasonable, the writers of the gospel, and they go out of their way to show Jesus, you know, allowing people to touch him and eating food. And so they know, they clearly know that what they're speaking about is not some apparition. As a matter of fact, I think that they're specifically trying to refute that, and they're doing it as people who are, like, if you read the Gospels, they come across as very reasonable people.
Right. Well, it's sober, and this is another
point. Yeah, sober, that's a good word.
People will often say, well, the Gospels are mythical developments, or they are apologetic inventions meant to bolster belief in the resurrection, not to record events that actually transpired. But I'm not convinced of that hypothesis for a few reasons. Number one, the canonical Gospels that we have, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they differ significantly from later Gospels that really are bent on apologetics first. A prime example of this would be the Gospel of Peter. The Gospel of Peter has been dated to, the middle of the second century or early second century, and its account of the resurrection has all of the Jewish leaders and Roman guards and the crowds at the tomb when Jesus rises. And the angels come down and roll a stone away. They come out and they're tall. Jesus comes out. He's like 50 feet tall. His head goes up into the clouds. But you have all of these witnesses. You can say, well, look, the Jewish leaders were at the tomb and the Roman guards were at the tomb. They all saw it. That is apologetic legend in action. But when you read the canonical Gospels, you don't see this. Now, some people say, well, when you read in Luke or John that Jesus says, I am of flesh, touch my flesh, see that I have hands and feet, that this is clearly a anti-docetic or docetic apologetic. The docetists claim that Jesus didn't have a real body. So they just invented that. That's possible. But it's also possible that, I mean, think about it. If you, well, this might even happen here. Imagine people thought that you died. Like, imagine, Cy, let's do a thought experiment here, that the Catholic Answers studio collapsed, and everyone's looking for Cy Kella, and they can't find him, and they just believe, well, he's died, and we have the funeral, and then you show up, and someone's like, oh, my gosh, it's the ghost of Cy, like, and we were convinced you were dead. You'd say, it's his ghost. You'd be like, I'm not a ghost. Look at this. I did a thought experiment where I only pretended to kill you.
I know. Congratulations on that. There. Things are getting a lot better between us, Trent. Thanks for that.
So it's interesting, right, that if in that case, if someone saw you and they was absolutely convinced you had died, absolutely convinced, they might think you were a ghost, right? If you saw a dead person, oh, you're a ghost, and you would, what would be your first thing to prove to them that you're not a ghost?
I'd smack them. Well, maybe.
Right, yeah.
That's how I would do it. Or Jesus would invite
Jesus,
you
like,
to
let's
touch
have some, let's have some fish.
Yeah.
You're right. I'm going to smack you upside the head.
Right, well. I'm not the
But
Lord.
That makes sense that if you were trying to communicate, I was dead, you know, in Revelation, what is it? I thought I was going to say Revelation 1:18, maybe. Jesus says, I once was dead and am now alive. I hold the keys to death. If you were dead, now you're alive, and you're trying to convince people, well, I'm alive, but I'm not a ghost, you would engage in, you would say, look, I have a body. You can touch it. I can eat fish. I'm not a ghost. Even though that's what people thought. Remember when Jesus was walking on water, the disciples saw and they thought it was his ghost. They thought it was his spirit. Or when Peter was seen in the book of Acts, rescued from prison, and there was the report that was given, you know, Peter has been released. They thought that, oh, she has just seen his ghost or his spirit. Well, no, he's trying, you know, so that's that's something that people would default to and Jesus would need to correct. If the resurrection appearances in Luke and John are merely anti-docetic, anti-docetic, apologetic things that were invented to refute docetism. Yes, Jesus had a body. You would not expect the authors to also include details that call into question whether Jesus had a body. Like in Luke, when Jesus appears to the two men on the road to Emmaus, it says he disappeared. He was.
Yeah.
It says that he, you know, they didn't recognize him, and then that he disappeared from their sight. well, that makes it seem like, what, you know, is he a spirit actually? How does a physical body disappear from sight from them?
Right.
Or in John's gospel, it says the doors were locked and then Jesus was in the midst of them. It's kind of a mysterious detail in that regard. How did Jesus get there? Did he phase through the doors? Did he teleport into the room? What is the detail? The doors were locked. I mean, it's possible they unlocked the doors for Jesus, but you know, when you read it, read the account, it's like, oh, there are details in here that also seem to call into question the physicality of Jesus's body, which you would not expect someone who is making up the account to do.
Yeah.
Rather, oh, this just all makes sense if they are just reporting all of the different unusual phenomena surrounding Jesus's post-resurrection appearances. And they are all explained if we say that, yes, Jesus had a physical body, but it was a glorified body, and so is not constrained in the same way my body or your body is constrained.
Which is not something that they would have expected.
That's correct. That's something they would not expect.
Right. So it's not like you made the point that if you're going to hallucinate, you hallucinate according to what you would expect or your beliefs. And
right.
And what they report is, I mean, you could say that certainly Jewish men of the first century are not expecting a bodily resurrection to happen today. That is just
not until the end of the world.
Yeah.
Would they not expect that bodily resurrection to happen.
All right, I got some more objections for you, however, and we'll see how you handle those when we come back on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Church Pop takes a fresh and fun look at the news shaping our world, featuring engaging, inspiring, and informative Catholic social media content. Find it on Snapchat, Instagram, and on the web at churchpop.com. And you can get Church Pop emailed directly to your inbox. Visit EWTN.com and click subscribe. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Happy Easter to you, our first broadcast of the Easter season. We're so happy you're here with us. And of course, what do we talk about first day back after the big Easter feast yesterday? Well, we talk about the resurrection of the Lord. Next hour, Tim Staples will be here with us. We'll continue the conversation. Trent Horn is with us this hour. And we're talking about the evidence that this is a historical event, that this actually happened in history, that the body of that Jesus was alive, and then he was dead, and then he was raised again to life. That actually happened, and it happened to him physically, is what is the Christian claim. And so I want to challenge you one other way on this, Trent. We have other miracle accounts. As a matter of fact, we have whole religions based on miraculous accounts, and we don't believe them, so why should we believe this particular miracle account? And I can even give you a recent example. We have the entire Church of the Latter-day Saints
right.
is based on a miracle, a purported miracle that Joseph Smith received golden tablets from an angel, and that four men witnessed these or saw these golden tablets. And these tablets were the revelation of the other kind of testament of Jesus Christ. So why would I believe the Jesus miracle and not believe the Joseph Smith miracle?
Right. And so this would deal, and this is something actually that I put forward in my opening statement as a kind of preemptive strike, if you will, because this is something that Doug has brought up, and other atheists and others will bring this up as well. And yeah, the objection goes like this. You believe in the resurrection, then you should believe in other non-Christian miracles that have the same, if not better, evidence. Now, what's interesting here is that, number one, this is not an argument against the resurrection. At best, all it would show is that Christians are inconsistent. It would just simply show that, we should believe in these other miracles, and or at least these other events happened, so we're being inconsistent. It does nothing to disprove the evidence that is offered for the resurrection itself. So that'd be point number one that I would raise. Though someone could try to come in and say, well, all these miracle claims can't all be true because they are theologically contradictory, so that is a significant problem. Well, it could be possible that these events did take place, but there are different theological reasons behind them. So the resurrection is an authentic revelation of God, but a miracle in a non-Christian religion, that could be God, you know, mercifully healing someone and the person attributes it to a false god. It could be the work of demonic elements, for example. And this is something I raised in about the Book of Mormon and Mormonism, that this is the claim that an angel named Moroni gave Joseph Smith in the mid-1820s, revealed the location of golden plates that chronicled the migration of Jews who lived in Judea, Mesopotamia during the time of Isaiah, who emigrated to the New World, started a new civilization there, and then Jesus appeared to them in the New World after sometime after his resurrection in Jerusalem. And so we have all this. And then the claim is that this was revealed miraculously to Joseph Smith, and then Smith, along with three other witnesses, Oliver Cowdery, David Whitmer, and Martin Harris, saw an angel reveal these plates in the early part of the 19th century. Now, number one, I might say, well, it's possible this happened, but this is this is demonic, and it's meant to lead people away from the gospel. And some reasons I have for that is it's interesting that Paul even says, if anyone preaches a gospel to you different from what we have preached, even if an angel from heaven should preach a gospel different than us, let him be accursed. And so, like, when I study the Book of Mormon, I know there is a significant problem there that I don't find in the Bible. Like, if you give the Bible to atheistic, any scholar, non-Christian, Jewish, atheist, they can at least read the Bible and make a map of where these events approximately took place. Here's Jerusalem, here's Bethany, here's Bethlehem. It all happened in roughly this area. Now, they might think the miracles didn't happen, but they could at least draw you a decent map. Here's where this all purportedly took place. The Book of Mormon is so vague in its descriptions, no one even knows where it took place. There are estimates that range as far as, you know, as from a narrow strip of land in Central America to all of North and South America to just a part of the American heartland or by the Great Lakes. So it's very unreliable. It doesn't seem like something that's actual history or divine revelation. That's also just even granting that that event had a supernatural cause. That I would say, Cy, that in many of these cases of parallel miracles, saying, well, you believe in the resurrection, but what about all this miracle, non-Christian miracle, and all its evidence? I would say it doesn't have as good evidence as the resurrection. When it comes to the Book of Mormon, we don't have a non-Mormon being converted by it, like we have in the case of Paul and Christianity. Instead, we have men who were Joseph Smith's financial backers, people that were close to him, and he told them to pray fervently. He took them out into the woods and said, pray really hard and you can see these golden plates, which is weird because Smith was translating the golden plates at this time, allegedly. He could have just shown it to the men. Instead, he's telling them to pray and pray a lot. And it appears that, and then later one of them, Martin Harris, said, I did not see the golden plates as I do that pencil case. I saw them with the eye of faith. It seems that they had a vision of seeing these things brought on by an ecstatic prayer experience. This would not be the same, that was primed and encouraged by Smith, not the same as the embodied experiences that happened to the much more diverse set of witnesses that we have for the resurrection. But it is really fascinating to see when people try to bring up these counterexamples. Why don't you believe in these other miracle claims? And it's very interesting that the evidence for the other miracle claims is much, much lower than we have for the resurrection. In fact, in the debate, I quoted Anthony Flew, who was at one time a very well-known atheist. He came to believe in God, but not Christianity. And he said this. He said when he was an atheist, The evidence for the resurrection is better than for claimed miracles in any other religion. It's outstandingly different in quality and quantity.
Yeah.
I think that's something that people really do need to grapple with. We have good evidence for this. And the other claims and other non-Christian religions, I don't think stack up as well.
No, these things were done in public and not in a cave where an angel spoke to someone or hidden away, but they were done in public and
right.
were seen. All right, so you've given us good, strong defenses of the resurrection. Are there other ways we might think about to defend the resurrection of Jesus?
Well, there are different approaches. One way to do that is to show the very minimal facts of Scripture attest to groups of people seeing Jesus, really focusing on the letters of Paul, for example. Another way is to talk about a maximal case about the Gospels' reliability, and that they really are, the Gospels and Luke, Acts really do communicate history in a reliable way and give us impressive details to lend more credibility to the accounts. And then just talking about, we can also focus a lot, and I mentioned this earlier in the show, the unexpected nature of Christianity, that if Christianity was just another failed messianic movement, like all the other ones, the followers of Simon Bar Kokhba, the leader of the Second Jewish Revolt, or the followers of Theudas or the Egyptian, these are other Messiah claimants mentioned in Acts of the Apostles or Josephus. Their followers don't believe that they'd risen from the dead. They just go and get a new Messiah. It really would require, what is the really reason that that Jesus's apparent defeat and apparent failure as a Messiah was not treated like these other failed Messiah claimants? Why was he different? And I would say the resurrection goes a long way in providing that crucial explanatory detail.
Do you buy the argument, too, that you can also judge the resurrection claims by their fruits, that what was born of those claims and grew from that and its transformative power within the Roman Empire and then throughout the world is also a testament, or no?
I think that it can serve as some confirming evidence, but we must be careful not to press it too hard.
Okay.
I do agree that when you see the differences here, seeing how Christianity spread in 300 years, different from, let's say, how Islam spread, primarily in a military conquest way versus how Christianity spread, I do see a lot of spiritual fruit in Christianity. The key there, of course, is why the original disciples pushed this message.
Yeah.
That is the key. Because you don't want to push this too hard, because let's go back to Mormonism. Mormonism has experienced tremendous growth since 1830.
Yeah.
And Mormons often lead very upright lives. They can demonstrate many things that appear to be fruits of the Holy Spirit, or at least natural virtue. But that in and of itself would not prove that Mormonism is true. So that's why I think it can provide confirmatory details, but we must be careful about pressing it too hard.
So would you say that in defending the resurrection, you can prove the resurrection of Jesus, or that you can prove that it's perfectly reasonable to accept these being two different standards? Which would you say?
Yeah, I think proof is always kind of a loaded term in that regard.
Yeah.
I think the evidence makes it definitely reasonable to believe that Jesus rose from the dead. I mean, a person could always propose alternative hypotheses, no matter how rare or extravagant or unusual or ad hoc, to deny belief in the resurrection because they weren't there to experience it for themselves. I think it provides a strong amount of historical evidence, or even historical proof, as you might say. But once again, I don't want to overstate my case. Belief in the resurrection does come down. We are moved by faith to accept the gospel. And this is a matter of faith, but it's not blind faith. It's faith that is based on very strong evidence that I would say makes it quite reasonable. And so this moves us to have a blessed and joyful faith. And I hope people have a blessed and a joyful Easter.
Well, I certainly hope you do, Trent. Thanks. I really appreciate you taking the time to have this Easter Monday conversation with us. Coming up next, we got, Trent's boss, but I don't know who's the boss of who around here anymore. I just know I get bossed around by everybody. So coming up is Tim Staples.
I thought Tony Danza, he's the boss.
Oh, that's right.
Now I remember
who's the boss. It was Tony Danza. Or Judith Light. Maybe she was the boss.
Yeah, I think she was boss.
We're going to talk about what Jesus did after the resurrection coming up next with Tim Staples.